Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. Inevitably, when one talks about protecting the country we love, you have to talk about China, because what the Chinese Communist Party is determined to do is not only endanger that country, but actually destroy it. A man who has understood this better than just about anybody and been warning about it just about, well, as long as anybody, is our first guest. A regular here, I'm very pleased to say, at Securing America, Gordon Chang. Gordon is an author, an essayist, an enormously influential contributor to the public policy debate about China. He is, among other things, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, something that may seem more imminent than ever at the moment. You can find him at Newsweek and Gatestone, Epic Times, and other places. You can also follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang. I strongly encourage that. Gordon, it's good to have you back, my friend. Welcome once again.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I want to talk to you about a number of pieces of what's developing that may indeed imperil the regime in China, praise God, but possibly with some untoward effects in the meantime. Let's talk about what is happening economically at the moment, Gordon, maybe starting with the bond market in China, which seems by some accounts to be imploding.
The Chinese bond market is imploding because foreigners are taking their money out. We've had something like five straight months or so of outflows. And some of these outflows have been a record. So, for instance, in March, $17.5 billion came out of that market. And this is, by the way, not an emerging markets story. This is just a China story because the other EMs are doing well, surprisingly. What's happening is that people are starting to understand the problems in the Chinese economy. There's the debt crisis, of course, maybe debt equal to, say, 350% of gross domestic product. We've got the big property companies defaulting, Evergrande, the mortgage boycotts, in other words, people not paying the banks. And then, of course, the bank runs. So it's just one problem after another. And Frank, you know, with the numbers that came out on Monday and with everything else, people are starting to see that the core of the Chinese economy, basically everything but exports, is just failing right now.
Gordon, are there still net positive infusions in the Chinese stock markets? Or is that also beginning to show this kind of trajectory?
It's the latter. It's starting to show a trailing off of money coming in. And that's because people on Wall Street have lost money. And I think people are starting to understand that Xi Jinping's attack on the private sector, specifically big tech, is not stopping. And because of that, you know, everyone thought, oh, you know, it was over about 4 or 5 months ago. Well, it's not. And that is leading to a reassessment. Now, I think that they still, you know, some people on Wall Street still are optimistic. But that view is becoming less and less common.
Yeah, even Larry Fink, as I understand it, has reconsidered his recommendation that it's time to triple the amount of money his investors are putting into China. And Gordon, I guess I would just add one point. It's not just that those on Wall Street are losing money. They're losing the money of American clients all over the country who have, in some cases, unwittingly had it placed in Chinese companies that are having the kinds of problems that you've talked about, among others. And Gordon, talk about the knock-on effects of this. Do you anticipate that this is going to create real threats to Xi's anticipated coronation at the People's Congress this fall?
Yeah, he wants his unprecedented third term, which he hopes to get at the 20th National Congress, which, if tradition holds, will be held October or November. The more recent indications, Frank, are that Xi Jinping will get that term. And, you know, he's showing a lot of confidence recently. So, for instance, in the last few days, There have been reports that he will meet President Biden on the sidelines of the G20 in Indonesia in November. He wouldn't be talking about meeting Biden if he thought that he was going to have a real problem at home. So this is an indication that he has got things solidified, which is, you know, crazy when you think about here. He's got a record of unmitigated disaster domestically. You know, it's not only the failing economy, but it's the zero COVID policies, which are obviously not working and irritating everybody inside China. But yeah, he's probably going to get his third term. The issue for everybody is whether he will be surrounded by people who don't share his views, because there has been some talk that that would occur. He'd get his third term, but he'd be surrounded, constrained. If he is constrained, it means there's going to be more infighting at the top of the Communist Party after the Congress.
Gordon, could I go back to something you mentioned a moment ago? Because I'd like to just tease it out with you. What is going on? It's actually two things that I'm interested in getting your take on. One is this issue of the continued crackdown and otherwise manipulating the market for big tech in China. The other is this COVID lockdown business, zero COVID, as you say. What's Xi thinking? And does it bear, to some extent, do you think, on some of the, the preparations for war that he keeps seemingly trying to engineer?
Yeah. Well, you know, just on the general point, China for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, has been mobilizing for war. And some of these things are obvious. So, for instance, amendments to the Mobilization Act, which were in place in the beginning of 2021, but also other things. You know, we've had these reports that the central bank and others have been getting officials to shed their foreign assets, to sanctions-proof them. There have been talk about how they can sanctions-proof the country's foreign exchange reserves. But it also is very little things that are indications. So, for instance, entrepreneurs are reporting that Communist Party cadres are going to them and telling them what they are going to make. And those and what they're told to make are basically material for war. Give you another example, just show you this is pervasive throughout society. Sorry for going on here, but I think that it's important. So, for instance, at the Macau University of Science and Technology, they're getting rid of all of their foreign lecturers. And people believe in Hong Kong and Macau that they're doing that because they want to get the foreigners out in preparation for war. So this is a society top to bottom, nothing overlooked. They're getting ready to go into battle.
And again, Gordon, as we've discussed in the past, this is against the backdrop of a video shot in apparently a senior party and military leadership meeting in Guangdong province, I think on the 14th of May, if memory serves, in which they were actively talking about implementing orders from Beijing to prepare that very important, very wealthy province for war, going, as they put it, from normal to war in 90 days. So we're well into that 90 days now. And I think what you're describing are symptoms, manifestations of the war footing that China is now getting on. Gordon, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more. And I want to talk with you, well, perhaps in the context of all of that, the warfare that China is waging with some of its friends against the dollar, and whether that's likely to succeed anytime soon, toppling the dollar from the reserve currency of the world status that we've long enjoyed, with devastating effects on both our economy and our national security. We'll talk about that and much more with the great Gordon Chang just right after this short commercial message. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Question: did the dozens of FBI agents who rummaged through former President Trump's Florida home do something more there than remove large quantities of sensitive documents? White House official turned talk show host Sebastian Gorka told Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic show last week that a recently retired 23-year veteran of the Bureau asserted, quote, given the amount of equipment they rolled into Mar-a-Lago and the fact they spent 9 hours there, he believes the Bureau planted surveillance equipment, bugs, inside the president's residence, unquote. The FBI raider's request that surveillance cameras inside Mar-a-Lago be turned off was reportedly not honored by the Secret Service. If so, an investigation into this suspicion should quickly confirm or deny whether Team Biden's efforts to get something, anything, on President Trump surpassed even the notorious Watergate break-in that drove a previous president, Richard Nixon, from office. This is Frank Affney. We're back. I'm pleased to say we are continuing a conversation with Gordon Chang, one of our duty experts and certainly very, very highly regarded colleagues on matters involving the dangers that we face from the Chinese Communist Party, its unrestricted warfare, its people's war, its biological weapons attack, all of which are the subject of a really important new report by our Team B3 entitled, The CCP is at War with America. It has a very important foreword by our guest, Gordon Chang, and I'm very grateful to him for contributing that. Gordon, I wanted to switch gears a little bit to talk about one particularly problematic line of attack that the Chinese seem to have had as a kind of idée fixe, as the French would say, a fixation for decades, namely trying to undermine and, if possible, dethrone the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. You've written a very important piece sort of sussing this out at Gatestone Institute recently, and I'd ask you to talk a little bit about, well, why this is so important, maybe for starters, and then what the Chinese are doing and whether they're likely to be able to pull this off.
Our economy depends upon our having the world's reserve currency. It gives the United States so much flexibility. So for instance, we can borrow in our own currency. We're not, if you borrow in somebody else's currency, you're at their mercy. But also it gives the United States enormous power to influence events around the world. So, for instance, we have sanctions, dollar-based sanctions, which we've imposed on Russia, for instance, this year because of the Ukraine war. And those sanctions have actually had an effect, not as much of an effect as we'd like, because they haven't been as comprehensive as I think they should be. But it shows you the power of the dollar. Well, China and Russia, especially because of these Ukraine war sanctions, have now stepped up their attacks on the dollar. At the BRICS meeting a couple of weeks ago, BRICS is that grouping of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. They were talking about establishing a new global currency, one that is based upon a basket of the five BRICS currencies. Now, I don't think that this is practical. I mean, you look at the euro as a problem, but the point is, it's not a question of whether they're going to succeed. It's a question they're continuing to attack. And the reason why this is important is because the Biden administration is taking actions that undermine the dollar. So the dollar is getting it from both ends. And that's why it's important that the Chinese and Russians at this particular time are going after the greenback.
Yeah. Just as an aside, I think you said the sanctions are not as comprehensive as one would like. They are being undermined, I think it's fair to say, by the Chinese and the Indians to varying degrees and others, making them less effective and really garroting the Russian economy as had been hoped by the Biden team. But on this issue of what the Chinese are doing, Gordon, you, in your piece at Gatestone, walk through what it takes to qualify, really, as a reserve currency of the world, and the difficulties that any of those BRICS countries, to say nothing of all of them together, have in really meeting those requirements. But most especially, you make the case that of them, the only one that really matters, that only really could possibly qualify, is the Chinese renminbi. And yet, as you point out, there are some real insuperable hurdles, perhaps, that Xi Jinping faces in trying to make his own currency, or his partners, the reserve currency in the stead of the dollar. Talk us through that, if you would.
Yeah, China from the 1990s has been openly talking about making the renminbi the world's reserve currency. And to that end, they've been talking since the 1990s about making it fully convertible. At this moment, the Chinese currency is convertible on the current account, but it's not convertible on the capital account, which means if you want to repatriate money out of China, you need approval. Also, as a practical matter, the currency is becoming less convertible on the current account because China is just not allowing people to convert and take out currency despite the rules. This is important because in order to have a global reserve currency, you have to have a number of meet a number of qualifications, as you point out. One of them is free convertibility. The other has got to be backed by a large and a sound economy. And there's a couple other things that we rarely talk about. One of them is that it's got to be administered fairly, and people have to have that perception around the world. And there's got to be enough of the currency outside the country of issuance to make it usable. And, you know, the U.S. runs big deficits, so there's a lot of dollars around the world. China, on the other hand, runs these big surpluses, so it has trouble making its currency widely available. But there are a lot of reasons, Frank, but I don't focus so much on the problems that China has. I focus on the things that we can do, because there are things that we can do to make sure that the dollar remains the world's reserve currency. But unfortunately, Biden and his predecessors as well have run up these enormous deficits. That means we're running up debt like crazy. We got now $30.6 trillion of debt. Federal
Gordon,
debt.
You essentially make the case that the only thing that really stands to imperil the dollar's reserve currency status is the Biden administration's policies. And it's not just running up the debt, is it? It's also other steps that they're taking that undermine this. And I wanted to ask you one correlation that I've heard made about the reserve currency is another criterion is the country whose currency it is has to be seen to be a preeminent and reliable military power. And one of the things that Joe Biden is clearly doing is taking down the United States military. We had a terrific webinar on this subject last Tuesday for our Committee on the Present Danger of China, Gordon, as you may know, in which we talked about essentially Biden's takedown of the military. To what extent is that, maybe it's a somewhat subjective judgment, but do you think that's operating as well?
Well, you know, the main requirement is you've got to have a large and sound economy. And to do that, it's got to be protected. We trade a lot. That means we need a U.S. Navy to protect goods as they cross the seas. We need a strong Air Force to protect freight, you know, cargo planes as they cross the oceans. So this is the reason why we have had this period of globalization is because the U.S. military has backed it. And people have felt that the skies and the seas are reliably safe. And the only reason they do that is because the U.S. has a military. So in that sense, I guess you can say that a military is a prerequisite for having the world's reserve currency. But the point here, as you mentioned, is that the Biden administration is undermining our lethality of our military. A friend of mine, his son is a second lieutenant in Europe, and said his son said to him, look, you know, Dad, we're just not lethal anymore. And that's really the issue going forward.
And again, in part, this is a matter of perception, not just actual, you know, capabilities in theory. But again, a point that was made in our program the other day is the extent to which the cumulative effects of these various policies, the purges, the critical race theory indoctrination, the driving of highly skilled, highly trained individuals out of the military because they refused to be vaccinated with these COVID vaccines. All of these are at work in, I think, affecting not only morale and unit cohesiveness and readiness, but perceptions of the fighting trim that the United States must have in its military if it is to deter aggression against us and our friends and allies, as you say, Gordon. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Gordon Chang, thank you for your time today, my friend. Follow him at Gordon G. Chang, as I do, and look for him next week at the same time. Gordon, it's great to talk with you. We'll look forward to that next visit. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work that you do at Newsweek and Gatestone, and of course, often in collaboration with us. We so appreciate it. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with Scott Powell, Dr. Powell, on America's penetration of North Dakota by a Chinese Trojan horse. That and more straight ahead.
Garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to continue our conversations about China and what it is up to, not over there, but over here, with an old friend and very valued colleague, Dr. Scott Powell. He is the author, most recently, of Rediscovering America, which he has described as kind of an historical and spiritual preparation for every American to understand the roots of our country, its extraordinary character, the values that we have long held dear and that are more important today, arguably, than ever. We're going to catch up with him a bit about something that he discovered in the course of his research about North Dakota, and specifically what the Chinese Communist Party's Fufeng Corporation is up to in close proximity to a very strategic U.S. military installation, Grand Forks Air Force Base. Scott Powell, it's great to have you back with us here at Securing America. Thank you for doing so, and tell us a bit about what Fufeng is, first of all, and what it is up to in North Dakota.
Well, Frank, it's great always to be with you. Fufeng is part of the Fufeng Group in China, mainland China, and I believe it's a state-owned enterprise. In any case, a company of its size would have a number of CCP members on its board and wouldn't undertake anything without CCP approval and even direction. Fufeng USA is a subsidiary, and it came and was formed in Chicago in the year 2020. And of course, they came for a strategic reason to acquire property and to pursue espionage, which all corporations that are Chinese sponsored do. And they were reviewing some 20 odd properties, and they chose to establish themselves in near Grand Forks, North Dakota. Now the chief operating officer of Fufeng USA, and he was recruited in Chicago, he himself admitted that of all of the locations they were looking at, Grand Forks was not the ideal place for a food enterprise and distribution center, but that he could make it work economically. But what's controversial about this location in Grand Forks, it's on the outskirts of Grand Forks, in the direction of the Grand Forks Air Force Base, which is one of the most sophisticated bases in the U.S. today, because it includes a Space Force unit there. So it's really a joint base now between the U.S. Space Force and the Air Force. And their main activity, one of the most important things, is the drone technology. They have unmanned aerial space, the most advanced vehicles there. They're testing them. They're working on them. And of course, these are tied not only to ground signals, but to satellite signals. And the Chinese are woefully behind in drone technology and in the satellite drone relationship. So they, of course, want to, you know, commit military espionage. They want to get as much information as they can. And from that location in Grand Forks, even though it's about 12 and a half miles away from the Air Force Base, they can intercept the uplinks and downlinks that are being conducted.
They're within the footprint, I guess is the way they would put it. Just a small corrective. I think the Chinese actually have very sophisticated drone technology, Scott. In fact, most of the drones that are available are unmanned aerial vehicles, as the military calls them, are made by China these days, including those sold in this market. I think what you're probably getting at is whatever their current status is with respect to the application of these unmanned vehicles to space, they're sure interested in whatever we're doing about it. And anything that they can police up or steal from us will wind up being translated, as we've seen in all other aspects of their military forces, being deployed probably by them before us, in fact, if not in certainly larger numbers over time. So, Scott, the question that occurs to me is there nobody in the United States government who is paying attention to these kinds of strategic plays by the Chinese Communist Party? Here you've got the FBI director, in among other places, Great Britain, warning that the theft of technology by the Chinese, and more generally what the Chinese are doing penetrating our country, constitutes a very major threat to our nation. But you'd have thought somebody would have thrown a flag on the idea of having the Chinese roll up a Trojan horse, as you put it, in close proximity to this strategic facility.
It's very hard to know. The Smithfield Foods acquisition was very troubling. But this, I think that they acquired the land. They started out just acquiring the land, and they had
330 acres, something
like that. Yeah, three different sellers. They aggregated three parcels. And obviously, probably some of that land wasn't really on the market for sale. So they probably paid these owners pretty well. It was not an it's not an optimum. 300 acres in the world of farming, unless it's connected with other farmlands, isn't worth farming anymore commercially. You really need big spreads.
Don't get those huge economies of scale.
And that's why they're using that land primarily as a site for a commercial building project, which would be this wet milling, corn wet milling project. Now, out of that is not going to come any of the products that Fufeng is known for. They are one of the biggest monosodium glutamate manufacturers, and they also produce something called xanthan, which is used for, as a food additive with a lot of foods. That's their main work in China. So this is new for them, which also raises questions about, is that really the purpose of this? And it would appear not to be.
Yeah. Monosodium glutamate, by the way, folks, is a food preservative, I guess, that has a lot of downsides to it. So
yeah.
Having the Chinese manufacturing that in large quantities here is probably not a good thing either. So, Scott, if you look at this arrangement, and there doesn't seem to have been much in the way of, if any, serious review by, you know, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States of the placement of this Chinese facility. The question that occurs to me is, even if there were no national security considerations, and even if this is all by the book, do we have any kind of reciprocal arrangements with China if we'd like to put something that we could use for collecting intelligence close to a Chinese military installation? Would the Chinese say, well, you know, we're doing it to you, so it's okay?
Of course not. This is very, you know, asymmetrical relationship with China. I mean, corporations that go into China, American corporations, are always joint ventures with a 51% ownership being Chinese. We have a minority ownership on all those joint ventures, and so they are in control. That's how they can acquire intellectual property and really get all kinds of information that would be harder if it was a symmetrical relationship.
Yeah, and eventually compete with that company and put it out of business as they migrate those, you know, intellectual properties and productive capacity to wholly owned Chinese companies there in the mainland. Which is a bait and switch we've seen done repeatedly to American companies. And it's always this dangling carrot of there's, you know, $1.4 billion toothbrushes that can be sold to all of those Chinese mouths that keep Americans coming back for more. But they, I think, fairly consistently find it to be very frustrating and often a terminal condition for their.
I would describe they manufacture the toothbrushes in China.
They do.
They brand
now,
them
for sure.
You know, Procter and Gamble, a brand name here, manufacturing.
Yeah. Scott, just last point. When you look at this affair in North Dakota, is there anything that can be done now to prevent the Chinese from this operation and having access to our sensitive information there?
The very organization that you referred to, CFIUS, is now looking at this.
About time.
But it came very late. They really didn't start that until June. The acquisition was made early in the year. So in any case, I do hope that they do all the necessary due diligence. And when in question, if it's regarding national security trumps everything.
It should. It certainly should. Except when it comes to the Chinese, as far as the Biden administration is concerned. And sometimes that's not so much the case. Scott, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for the work that you've done. There's an important piece by you at Town Hall about all of this entitled A Chinese Trojan Horse in Grand Forks, North Dakota. We'll be watching closely, as I know you will, whether CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, actually steps up and does something about this national security threat. I think there's no question about that. In the meantime, Scott, congratulations once again on Rediscovering America. A terrific book that I think is probably been never more needed than today when Marxists are trying to really take us away from our roots, from our history, and from our values. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Discovery Institute and elsewhere. Come back to us again soon.
Thanks, if you would.
Next up, we will speak with This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Question: did the dozens of FBI agents who rummaged through former President Trump's Florida home do something more there than remove large quantities of sensitive documents? White House official turned talk show host Sebastian Gorka told Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic show last week that a recently retired 23-year veteran of the Bureau asserted, quote, given the amount of equipment they rolled into Mar-a-Lago and the fact they spent 9 hours there, he believes the Bureau planted surveillance equipment, bugs, inside the president's residence, unquote. The FBI raiders' request that surveillance cameras inside Mar-a-Lago be turned off was reportedly not honored by the Secret Service. If so, an investigation into this suspicion should quickly confirm or deny whether Team Biden's efforts to get something, anything, on President Trump surpassed even the notorious Watergate break-in that drove a previous president, Richard Nixon, from office. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. One of the high points of our week is at hand, I'm pleased to say. It is our visit with Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a man who brings a wealth of experience to the topics that he covers brilliantly there, and I'm pleased to say every week here about this time. He is, among other things, a former maven on Wall Street, a president of the large Wall Street firm called Allied Capital Corporation, and among other things, a former president of the Council for National Policy, a very important conservative organization of which I'm proud to be a member. Bill Walton, it's good to have you back as always, sir. Welcome.
Frank, great to be talking with you.
So much to cover. Let's start with China, one of our favorite topics, Bill. You are a man who I think has really come to understand the magnitude of the challenge that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party and the folly of underwriting that challenge on Wall Street. We got what seems to be some good news last week that the Chinese decided to pull several of their large corporations out of the New York Stock Exchange. What are we to make of that?
Well, this is part of an ongoing negotiation. The Chinese have listed hundreds of firms on U.S. exchanges, and the problem with that, of course, is we don't have any financial information or audit information about any of those companies. And finally, we're waking up to the fact that that's a problem. We need to know what their financials are. More importantly, we need to know how strategically they're linked to the Chinese Communist Party. Trump had moved to really aggressively delist them. And surprisingly, Biden has kept up that momentum. And the most recent development is that they're going to delist, I think, five state-owned enterprises, they call them, state-owned by the Chinese Communist Party, as kind of a sop to the negotiation. And I say sop because the distinction between a state-owned enterprise in China and one that is merely controlled by the Chinese Communist Party is really a distinction without a difference. Yes. I mean, every company, every resident in China, Chinese citizen, is required first to owe its allegiance to the Chinese Communist Party, whether they're in the country or out of the country, and that holds true for all the big, medium, and small companies. So, yes. We're negotiating something that I think is a little bit arcane. You know, it still leaves companies like Alibaba and some of the other big tech companies listed here, and as we've seen, that, you know, trillions of dollars, I think the number is trillions, I've lost track of billions, trillions, or whatever the next number is, I've gone into Chinese companies, and we now know that they're using those dollars to support their international aggression.
Yeah, their ambitions for global dominance, to put a fine point on it. So, Bill, I guess what we're hearing is that we're seeing, you know, ongoing negotiating gambits with respect to the accounting that the Chinese have thus far not provided us, as in part a result of a memorandum of understanding largely engineered by Joe Biden back when he was vice president of the United States. It's high time we actually know what the books of these companies are, whether they're state-owned enterprises or, as you say, simply Chinese Communist Party-controlled ones.
Well, the sooner
they're out of our market, the better, as far as I'm
concerned. And as I joked with you the last time, I'm an accounting geek. I worked my way through business school, inflicting accounting instruction on accounting majors. And these audit papers are really very interesting things to look at because they include all of the vendors and the technology used. And as we joke last time, depreciation schedules are often helpful to know what kind of technology they own. So this is an important strategic consideration for the United States. And given China's open declaration of war, we need to move to end their access to the capital markets.
Amen. Bill, speaking of things that we need to be doing, one thing clearly also is to be ending our acute dependence, including, it turns out, for military supplies on chains that emanate from China, supply chains, as they're called. We did a wonderful Committee on the Present Danger China webinar on this subject the other day, and it's just mind-boggling that we still are as critically reliant upon the Chinese for so many things, from medicines to chips to rare earth minerals. And now it turns out even some key components of our military weapon systems are unbelievably relying on the Chinese to supply us. How acute is this problem as you see it, and how urgent is it that we fix it?
Well, the short answer, it is acute. You know, you accused me of being a recovering maven. Well, I hope I'm still a maven, but I'm certainly
definitely a maven.
I'm certainly a recovering free trader, particularly a unilateral free trader, and part of the U.S. strategic plans for the last two, three decades has been to open up our markets to China and to do business with them. And most importantly, to offshore most of our manufacturing, a lot of our critical manufacturing to China. And those things are coming home to roost. And now we find ourselves something as mundane as batteries. The Department of Defense now says that they're buying 94% of lithium hydroxide batteries. For all you technical people out there, I think that's just the standard battery. The lithium battery is 70%, basically 2/3 to 90% of our batteries that are used in defense applications are made in China. They've also
what
got
could possibly go wrong.
Well, and you know, we talked about this before. Rosemary Gisman points out that almost all of our critical pharmaceuticals are manufactured in China, or at least subcontracted. They've got to go through China one way or another. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to use the whip hand they've got on our supply chain. Back when the pandemic was breaking, they considered cutting off antibiotics just to sort of put a little extra pressure on the United States.
And all those personal protective equipment gear as well. Bill, very quickly, just a thought about the latest development out of the Congress on China. They had an amendment offered, as I recall, in the Senate the other day, in which the Senate would take the position that the Chinese should not be able to buy oil from our Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That was defeated on a party line vote. Just a quick thought on what's up with that?
Mystifying, Frank. Mystifying. We talk about China.
Bill, I'm over time. Hold on. We're going to come right back to this and more with Bill Walton right after this. Back, and I have to apologize to our guest Bill Walton for unceremoniously stopping him mid-answer to a question that I posed. Bill, let's go back to it. We're talking about the Democrats in the United States Senate insisting that the Chinese Communist Party must be able to buy oil from our strategic petroleum reserves. I must tell you, I thought that was a stunning position to take. What did you make of it?
Well, lots of words describe it: appalling, mystifying. Words fail, really. I mean, why they would want to allow us to sell our oil to China when we're in the midst of this incredible energy crisis and gas prices being as high as they are. Peter
from Schweizer, our strategic petroleum reserve, which is a kind of wartime contingency stockpile. No.
Well, Biden's already decided to sell that off. Whether it's to the Chinese or to anybody else, they're reducing our strategic reserves, and that's troubling, particularly when we could simply open up the pipelines or the drilling and be energy independent again.
Right.
Peter Schweizer talks about the elite capture, but this is not his term. It's the Chinese term. Mm-hmm. And they've gone into every country in the world, really, and tried to find elites that they can get serving their interest. And you really have to wonder about the Democrats in the Senate as to why they would vote to sell oil to China. This seems to be a layup.
Well, and again, it's not just oil. It's oil that we are supposed to have on hand in case of national emergency and national security emergency. And as far as I can tell, we're probably just moving it into their stockpiles because they're rather feverishly.
Well, they do seem to be on a war footing. That is true.
I'm afraid. Bill, speaking of things that the Senate has been up to, among others, on Capitol Hill, we've recently had enacted, it's awaiting the president's signature, I think that will be happening momentarily, something called the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's been widely ridiculed for having no value in terms of reducing inflation, but it does have one really ominous provision, and I wanted to draw on some of your experience with the Trump transition, working on, among other things, Internal Revenue Service related topics. The IRS is going to get 87,000 more armed agents with job descriptions that they must be willing to use lethal force. Again, what could possibly go wrong with that?
Well, as you know, everything can go wrong with that. I mean, and you're citing the classified ads that are online about the qualifications for people ought to be able to qualify to apply for the job, which is that you're comfortable using small arms and comfortable enforcing rules with force. So that's troubling just on its face. But backing up to what the IRS really needs, you mentioned I was fortunate enough to work for President Trump before he was president, working on action plans for the various financial agencies and governments. And one of the ones I oversaw was the Internal Revenue Service. And I went from somebody who didn't want to spend another dime on the Federal Reserve to somebody who thought, the Internal Revenue Service. Mm. To something we could actually fix a lot of the issues we have with it if they would just invest some real dollars in information technology. Hmm. I mean, the IRS is still using COBOL systems that go back to the 1960s. In fact, they've got a death list there of people who still know how to program their computers, and these are the same computers that are churning out your tax returns, your tax refunds, or their claims that you owe them more money. Instead of spending audit papers. Well, yes. And instead of spending all that money on agents, which we know is simply to harass people, in particular conservatives, if you would take a like amount of money and spend it on information systems, you could actually have a pretty good experience with the IRS. The IRS now is really not returning phone calls. You can't reach them either by phone or by email or by any other mechanism. Maybe smoke signals might work given the state of their technology. But there is an opportunity, and this bill completely misses it in the interest of I think, political payback.
Yeah. Bill, let me just probe on this, because it seems to me the least of it is harassment and audits and the like. What seems to be going on here, especially when you combine this, classified job descriptions and they're not classified in the secret sense. They were, they're, you know, in the sense of, you know, a Federal Register request for people to apply, provided they have law enforcement experience, they're willing to bear arms and use them.
Yeah.
In circumstances that are unclear. But you combine that with a very large acquisition of weapons and ammunition for the IRS, and it seems to a lot of us as though this is kind of leading to, well, some kind of new militia or paramilitary force that can be used for, again, weaponized as so many other agencies.
We've talked about it. The Biden administration has a whole of government approach to all their agendas, whether it's climate or critical race theory, or in this case, elections. And, you know, the IRS is just the latest and most visible agency to arm itself to the teeth. I mean, Homeland Security and a lot of the other agencies are doing exactly the same thing. Department of Energy, I believe, has its own enforcement operation. And, I'm joking, but I think if we looked at it carefully, maybe the Department of Education has got an enforcement group.
It sounds like it's probably
it's across the whole of government, and it's extremely troubling. And, I said, this is the most obvious. I can only hope that we reverse this, because the last thing this country needs is 87,000 armed agents looking. And by the way, this is going to fall disproportionately on middle income taxpayers.
Even lower, some say. It's
and, you know, people with higher incomes can afford expensive lawyers and tax attorneys to protect themselves from a lot of the egregious stuff. Middle income people cannot.
Not so much. Yeah. Bill, we have to leave it at that for today. Thank you very much for your time. Host of The Bill Walton Show, among many other wonderful attributes, a regular here at Securing America. We always appreciate you joining us. We appreciate the rest of you doing the same, and hope you will do it again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney, and I want to thank you for taking aboard what we need to protect the country we love. I ask you to go forth and multiply.